Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Christine Fair, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who was a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow at the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. Welcome to Background Briefing, Christine Fair.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And the capital flight out of Afghanistan by Afghanistan's elite to the United Arab Emirates apparently is ticking up considerably. It's been going on for some time. The UK Telegraph did a story on it back in 2010 on the Karzai family's $150 million worth of property there. I imagine they've added to that. But I'm also reading that these so-called poppy palaces in the elite part of Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, they're up for sale now. The property prices have declined as much as 35% since 2011 because the rich are getting out of town. I mean, why are we spending our blood and treasures defending this country when its elite are jumping ship?
Well, you know, speaking to those poppy palaces, I mean, it turns out, I mean, you know, years ago I worked with the United Nations. And what was happening in the early days of the Afghan war effort is that these warlords, whatever we want to call them, they're basically taking advantage of the high prices in the real estate market in Kabul, primarily catering to this glut of international organizations that had very specific requirements. You know, obviously Americans don't go to Afghanistan and live in squalor. So there were certain expectations about the living arrangements that they would have. Now, you know, these would often be shared living arrangements, but nonetheless, these were literally palatial residences. And because there was so much international presence in Afghanistan, the rents that they could charge would rival any large American city. I mean, I remember I lived in an abject hovel in Afghanistan, and I still had to pay over $1,000 a month. I mean, if you could see the place I lived in, it was, you're kidding me, I'm paying $1,000 for this. I didn't even have functioning running water. But the narco traffickers and other people involved in various illegal activities were laundering those monies through these residences, and they themselves never actually lived there. So you had this really funny secondary economy where these international organizations were basically renting from these very dubious people that had laundered this money into these vast narco palaces, or these poppy palaces, as they're called. Now we're kind of winding down from that. And even though for the last several years, it was very difficult for the poppy palace owners to get the same kind of rents that they had been able to get several years ago. And now that the rental market's virtually crashed, right, because the internationals are leaving, or in the case of the Americans, they're basically retrenching to their compounds and their embassies, and they're not approving basically off-campus living. So that whole market's crashed, and now that they can't get renters, they're trying to sell them. But my heart's not really crying, because in many cases, the monies that we're talking about were ill-gotten through illicit activities. I think there's a larger issue that no one's thought about really ever from the beginning, was that there's never been an economic plan for Afghanistan, right? It is a rentier state. It's a rentier state that we've built bigger than the rentier state that the Soviets built. And the entire economy is driven by the presence of these internationals. So if you're a driver working for the United Nations, you're making $1,200 a month. And so how do you transition Afghanistan away from this hyper internationalized war zone economy into something that's more realistic and sustainable? And so I see a lot of economic bad news for Afghanistan, and I don't think there's any way of avoiding it.
Well, I spoke a little while ago with Peter Galbraith, who was the number two official in the UN, I think probably at the time that you were working there, overseeing the elections.
He came after me, actually.
Right. But he was there
during the 2009 disaster Olympics.
Right. But he blew the whistle on Karzai's fraud, and he was undercut by the Norwegian guy, the head of the delegation.
Kai Eide.
Right. And eventually was forced out. But I think in retrospect, you know, he was right. Had they had another election, maybe, and stopped the fraud, maybe Karzai wouldn't have succeeded. And what Karzai's doing now is so obvious by not agreeing with the agreement that even his own lawyer, Jerger, have come up with. He's basically wants to delay signing the agreement with the U.S. until after the election so he can make sure that his hand-picked successor wins and by fraud again. Isn't that what's going on?
So, you know, first of all, I'm much more pessimistic. I don't think there's anyone in Afghanistan who has clean hands, whether we're talking about lack of blood on their hands or someone who's not corrupt. I don't think that is really something that's there. I also think that we need to understand that the Americans built this fraud system into the current government ab initio, and it really began with Zalmay Khalilzad's ambassadorship when he was there. He took, and this is totally illegal, the Afghan government employees were being paid through the World Bank Trust Fund. He had USAID working through these various contracting firms give them secondary salaries. And essentially what the Americans did, apart from building in this corruption from the beginning, we also violated numerous laws in doing so. And I've known about this story for quite some time, and journalists for many years actually were very hesitant to take it on. And I don't know if you saw Eli Lake's reporting on this. So I think when we talk about this corruption, it's really easy to just put the blame on Afghans. But from the beginning, we wanted Afghans that we could buy. Now, you have to put your position, imagine if you were Karzai, when you realize that all of your staff were basically being paid secondary salaries by the Americans. And he did learn this because one of the individuals who later became the Afghan ambassador to the United States had printed out an email detailing this and left it on the printer. So from the beginning, we built in a system that was driven on corruption. Everything from if you want the G-locks, right, moving supplies through the ground lines of control, starting from Karachi up until the point that it arrives in Bagram or goes into Kandahar through the south. If you want those things to arrive, you've got to pay bribes to any number of people. So the really sad story is that Americans really do want to flog the Afghans for their industrial strength corruption. But we've facilitated it, and we've benefited from it. Even in that election in 2009, and I remember I'd gone to Afghanistan several times that year, the Bush administration wanted Karzai to win. We were using USAID monies to basically run what was his local governance initiative. Now, that sounds great to the American who loves local governance, but what he was doing was using that local governance directorate to put into place chiefs of police and governors that would help basically steal the election for him in this industrial strength fraud. By the time Obama won the election and saw what was happening in Kabul, the train had sailed, and it was really impossible to walk that fraud back. And you'll remember how anti-Karzai Obama was, and for good reason. So it's so easy to think about this as an Afghan problem. But I'm going to argue very strenuously that this is a system that we built, and we wanted corruption so that we could continue to buy these people. And I think what your listeners have to understand is that, you know, it was like putting money in a parking meter, but that we were never getting the value that we thought we were getting.
And, of course, the ticket is the trillions of dollars. Well, we don't know what the full cost is of this war.
Oh, yes.
But we are now getting a little bit of a flavor of some of the retribution, if you will, from Robert Gates's new memoir that comes out next Tuesday. It's the New York Times and Washington Post have got advanced copies. But I was just looking at some quotes from Robert Gates trashing Obama and trashing Vice President Biden. And what Gates's criticism of Obama was that he didn't trust his own generals. Well, hello. did you read the article in the Rolling Stone that led to McChrystal's firing? He didn't like Karzai. In fact, he hated Karzai. Hello, that sounds like a good idea. I mean, somebody that's got it right. Everything that Gates is throwing at Obama makes Obama look good.
Everything that I've seen about this lamentable memoir suggests everything that I knew about Obama, that he knew this was a load of crap. And what I am really angry about this industry of coinistas. One has to recall...
Coin being counterinsurgency.
Counterinsurgency, yes.
Right.
Counterinsurgency, coin, a wooden nickel. They were so hyped up on this fictitious belief that McChrystal's notion of waging population-centric counterinsurgency won Iraq. And now, to even say that Iraq was won makes I choke on my laughter. But they were so convinced that the surge in Iraq worked, that this would necessarily work in Afghanistan. And this entire industry of snake oil salesmen, and I'll name them by name because I have no shame, Exum, Kilcullen, McChrystal himself, Petraeus, the various think tanks, the Seth Jones, I mean, you go up, the Institute for the Study of War, they were all on this coin gravy train, and it is very much a lucrative gravy train. And they shoved this down Obama's throat. You'll recall in the summer of 2009, McChrystal's interim commander's assessment was leaked, conveniently leaked. Now, once it was leaked, of course, all of the same people that were a part of that assessment project were then sent out in droves to engage the media, to engage the public population that we need to have this surge. Now, anyone who read that report, including me, noticed that there's already a problem. There were actually two parts to that report. One was this surge, a demand for 40,000 extra troops. It wasn't driven by battlefield effects. It was pulled out of the Star Chamber's hind end. It had absolutely no justification for this figure. But leaving that aside, the report also clearly called for a need for better governance, better leadership at all levels in Afghanistan if this population-centric fantasy was ever going to work. Now, no one wanted to pay attention to that because we were never going to get this. So in the absence of being able to deal with the corruption, for which we are in large measure responsible, they focus on the one thing that they could control, which is how many troops and what they did. Obama did not want this. Then, thanks to the various talking heads that were a part of the assessment process to begin with, who began writing op-eds about how we needed the surge, they then developed allies in the Congress. And where I fault Obama was that Obama's vice president, Biden, said COIN, i.e. counterinsurgency, is a disaster. What we need is a counterterrorism plan. And that's been a plan that I've advocated since 2008, for sure, if not earlier. Where Obama really failed was that he did not stand up to the generals. He let the general McGinn subordinates run this policy. Now, these very same people who had this fantasy, who were wrong to begin with, are writing yet a whole other series of memoirs to start a whole other gravy train saying how they were right, but they were undermined. And it is the most disingenuous rubbish.
Well, very reminiscent of the rubbish that came out after Vietnam, that if only we had listened to the generals, we would have won. I mean, the reason that we lost was we did listen to the generals, you know.
Absolutely.
So it looks like history repeating itself. So just in closing then, Chris Fair, what's your sense of whether Gates's memoirs are going to, you know, have the kind of debate that we need to have, because we are getting out, and I imagine, it's, you know, given what Iraq looks like, we may have a similar disaster in Afghanistan. So maybe it's time for us to get some honesty here.
What I would like to see is a congressional hearing where they haul up the Andrew Exums, the Seth Jones, the Petraeuses, the Kilcullens, basically all the people that have been hawking this counterinsurgency nonsense, and say to them, in 2008, sir, this is what you said. In 2009, sir, this is what you said. All of this has absolutely empirically proven to have been false. And you should have known it was false at the time you said it, because other people knew it was false. I'd like to hear these people be held accountable, because at the end of the day, while they're thinking about their professional trajectories and they're thinking about the books that they write and their think tank positions and all of their access to power, at the end of the day, those people are responsible for the deaths of thousands of Americans, tens of thousands of Iraqis and Afghans, and I don't know what the final number is, several trillion U.S. dollars, and they need to have responsibility. They need to own that. They need to be held accountable. This free pass to these charlatans really has to stop.
Well, Christine Farah, thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Have a fabulous day.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Christine Farah, a former United Nations political officer in Afghanistan, who was a professor in the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. Her books include The Madrasa Challenge, Militancy and Religious Education in Pakistan, and Fortifying Pakistan, The Role of the U.S. Internal Security Assistance. She's also a senior fellow with the Counterterrorism Center at West Point. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.